Kate Lilly's going to, her talk is called Voices Off, Tilting an Australian Obliquity.
As I said to Jean before, that's one of these titles that can, you know, do anything, be anything, wittingly. And I confess that some of the time I thought I'd be writing this paper, I was actually writing poems here, some of which I read last night. So I think, you know, there's a kind of virtue in that. But as you know, one day is a different day than another. And, you know, one of the very first poems I ever sent out when I was a little kid to some school magazine, they sent back a thing, you know, it happens this early, saying, "No, your work has merit of a kind, but not of the kind we seek." I was like, eight. So, you know, fuck them, I'm doing all right. Okay, so the other title for this paper, one of many perhaps, is Inescapable Complaint, which is a reference to Patricia Parker's wonderful book, Inescapable Romance. So today I want to begin by acknowledging the life's work of two brilliant emigre American scholars, both of whom died recently in their mid-50s, same age as me. Svetlana Boym, intermediate artist and professor of Slavic studies at Harvard, coiner of the, to me, indispensable term off-modern. You know, all these terms, ultra-modern, off-modern, Boyn called, coined off-modern, theorist of nostalgia, memory and memorialization. She died last August. And the Enlightenment scholar Srinivas Aravamudan, author of Tropicopolitans and Enlightenment Orientalism, amongst other tour de force critical essays, died a few days ago at Duke. In her off-modern manifesto, as she calls it, part of the website with the domain name SvetlanaBoym.com, still active, or memorialising her, her work, the website she called Book of Complaints and Comments, she writes, "The prefixes avant and post appear equally outdated or irrelevant in the current media age." Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
The same goes for the illusions of trans. But this doesn't mean that one should try desperately to be in. There is another option, not to be out, but off. As in off stage, off key, off beat, and occasionally off colour. I was brought up to particularly value the off-colour. I say in a heartfelt way, you know. That's my father's legacy. One doesn't have to be absolutely modern, as Rambo once dreamed, this is still Boyne, but off-modern, a lateral move, a detour into some unexplored potentialities of the modern project. Close quote. Aligning herself with what she calls broken tech art, quote, not Luddite but ludic, and Benjamin's interest in short shadows, it's Benjamin's phrase, and thresholds, aura, Boym praises Benjamin's oblique lucidity and his staging of the exemplary unstable relays, crossings and returns of aesthetic theory and practice. Aravamudan's Tropicopolitans strategically borrows its title from natural history, where it refers to species dominant in the tropical regions and redeploys it as, quote, a name for the colonised subject who exists both as fictive construct of colonial tropology and actual resident of tropical space, unquote, a name which rebounds equally on those crucial Enlightenment categories, the metropole and the cosmopolitan. Seeking to, quote, activate the tropological in the tropicopolitan, Aravamudan adopts the Deleuzian term virtualization, glossed as retroactive focalization in the constitution of plural histories of the present, in order to stress the overdetermined and cathected production of texts, subjects, and markets. Alongside tropicopolitan and virtualization, these key words, Arava Mudan proposes Levantinization as a term through which to particularize and, quote, reconfigure critical approaches to Orientalist humanisms by means of, quote, a strategic deformation of Orientalism's representational mechanisms, unquote. Most particularly, Arava Mudan concentrates on a detailed critique and tropicalization of the project of nationalist literary history, particularly for him, the history of the novel. For him, every text represents a sequence of rhetorically and ideologically over-invested instances, which in turn solicit readings likewise necessarily mobile and constrained, as Pam said, witting and unwitting, seeing and blindsided. However, his sense of interpolation and positioning is, I think, notably productive. And I mean, here, you know, I could get into a thing about the decolonial and the tropicopolitan. The decolonial. There are people here who work much more closely with that term, and I feel I'm only learning about it really. But as I understand it, it's a more wittingly utopic term. But there's, you know, there's interesting connections between them. So for Arava Mudan, the connections implied by virtualization are always reversible rather than teleological. So that's important, I think. To track this two-way process, he engages the rhetorical term metalepsis, a term I've always been keen on, both in Gérard Jeannette's narratological sense. I've always been a huge fan of Jeannette. Jeannette's sense of the hinge between, quote, the world in which one tells and the world of which one tells, unquote, and the more psychoanalytic and deconstructive, perhaps more politicised senses of buried echo and uncanny trace at play in the sight of darkness. It's a chiasmic formulation. Capacious and yet paradoxically stripped of detail. Oh, have I just gone on to... Oh, yeah. Now I'm going on to back to complaint. So it's all a bit crazed. So tropicopolitan complaint. Capacious and yet paradoxically stripped of detail, female complaint, as it is often referred to historically, describes the problematic of expression as such, the melancholic ground of figurability, iterability, and address at the threshold of life and death, usually last words or posthumous words, prosopopoeia, reanimated speech. So in that sense, complaint as a kind of finale, set piece, aria or recitative is also notable for its extraordinary generic mobility or plurality. Poeticized apostrophic speech, strongly associated with ekphrasis and performatively framed as female or feminized utterance. Motives of woe. So here, in the background of this paper, I'm thinking mainly at the moment about Pam and Gig and myself and the category of female scholar poets more broadly. Lynn, Carla, many people here. And about the tradition, the critical tradition in which work on complaint and female complaint is embedded. Motives of woe, the resonant phrase from the anthology edited by the Cambridge scholar John Kerrigan, his anthology of Lover's Complaint, which more or less defined the field. He suggests not only the complainant's causal promptings, but also, quote, the surges of emotion which motivate her words and which lead her to use or be used to channel received motifs within those moving discourses are what's at stake. this interplay of mobility and stasis in the arresting and moving spectacle of full-throated utterance, not just of distress, but, you know, complaint also in the sense of critique, rage, speaking back, some kind of eruptive, apostrophic discourse. That speaks to both an allegory of the scene of textuality or a certain kind of model of textuality and the affective as gendered and sexed, but also to a particular kind of text event or performance threshold, and to an anthology or a genealogy of transhistorical or legendary gendered experience. Complaints longing, to borrow Susan Stewart's polyvalent word. So I'm back in the, you know, I'm in the 90s, homage to the 90s here. Patricia Parker, Susan Stewart, you know, these are Ovidian heroines of mine. Are thus inseparable from the most fundamental interests or motives of rhetoric, poetics, hermeneutics, of writing, speech, genre, mode, the crisscrossed pleasure pain of what Barthes infamously called lover's discourse, a text I still love also, though it's kind of, you know, I've read far too many essays about it. But Barthes, to know that one does not write for the other, to know that these things I am going to write will never cause me to be loved by the one I love, the other, to know that writing compensates for nothing, sublimates nothing, that it is precisely there where you are not. This is the beginning of writing. For Barthes, what he terms lover's discourse is most affecting when it approaches the neutral or degree zero. He associates with the modern existential anti-realist poetic novel, or anti-novel, the nouveau roman, and its hollowing out of gender, character, narrative. Complaint, on the other hand, draws its energies from a rather different, inexhaustible literary history, inseparable from the poetics of gender and sexual critique, most iconically instantiated and perhaps initiated, often taken to be initiated at any rate, by Ovid's Heroides, and still going strong in texts like Kate Zambrino's Heroines, recently published by Semiotext, her Ovidian homage to modernist literary wives, mistresses, and, in her words, fucked up girls like me. And her blog, you know, which I'm sure you know, Frances Farmer is my sister, you know, a kind of perfect, you know, iteration of female complaint in that sense. But of course, from the side of feminist theory and affect theory, complaint these days is a, you know, a resurgent term, even female complaint, through the work of Lauren Berlant on affect, citizenship, and modes of intimacy, stemming from her essay first published in Social Text in 1988, The Female Complaint, and later the title of the book, published in 2008, and still very much, you know, there in the thread, at the centre of her, you know, very influential recent, more recent, Cruel Optimism, 2011, and Desire Love, 2012, a collaboration with Lee Edelman, and in her blog, Supervalent Thought. Everybody knows this, I'm sure, but anyway, a relation of cruel optimism, she says in an interview, I've just happened to take it from there, is a double bind in which your attachment to an object sustains you in life at the same time as that object is actually a threat to your flourishing. So that's a good definition of female complaint, I think. So now, it's all going to be a bit disjointed, but now I want to sort of turn to stuff about Pam. Gig is in here, but not in here. She's in here. And I've written scrawled things but about ventriloquy and so on, but that'll have to come out another day. But just first of all, to get to Pam, I want to read a poem from Missing Up called A Second Ago. I see my mother as a type of gerbera. I think you're sitting there. And have always known babysitting anyone's mess can be another person's reward. My predecessors, I love them, but don't want to imitate them. Living in rest of world, knowing they, my predecessors, were in main world, Europe, Japan, North America. Debates rail across Creative Commons. I take a few of James Schuyler's peonies. Maggie Nelson takes the bluets. Spluttering in the city, conditioned to fortune, against huge smoking days rolling in. Wild flames, crown stands of eucalyptus, the sun a carmine lake. My mother likes to know the wind's direction and to say it. It's a northwesterly, and the rain comes with a southerly. I would like a speculative set of laws that are friendly to life. That's the main thing, and that's all, really. Just as I was feeling sorry for the line break, it all happened again a second ago. I love that poem. So the practice I aspire to as a female poet scholar, this thing I've finally worked out, you know, to call myself, and of course, you know, I want its heroic Ovidian genealogy. My interest lies principally in transhistorical, transnational, intermedia, encounter and exchange in a queer feminist framework. But in practice, at the level of publication and giving papers, not quite so much in teaching, what that has tended to mean across my career, you know, my adult life, my post-PhD life, has meant talking about different aspects of that to different audiences in different places. So talking about 17th century women's writing to scholars who specialise in 17th century English women's writing, mainly English but not exclusively, talking about American text to Americans or certainly Americanists, about Australian work to Australians. Australians and Australianists are usually the same thing. Not in every single instance. Nicholas Burns is like, you know, he's about it, you know, for the, you know, he's the American Australianist. You know, and so on and so on. I could keep, you know, they're the main ones maybe. To such an extent and for so long that it's made me, to myself, a kind of multiple. An experience that increasingly I've been able to negotiate more productively, I think, in my poetry than anywhere else. It's probably why I, you know, was writing it. But I do think this, you know, multiple personality thing is to a great extent geo and bio politically conditioned and implicated. This toponym, Australia, Pam talks about, writes about toponyms, the Antipodean, the Antipodal, the passport I use to enter and exit borders, inscribes a distance that is never simply literal, or perhaps not even mainly literal. This separation or relation, orientation to what Pam calls rest of world, main world, and, you know, this is why, no doubt, we're all, we Australians, and perhaps you Americans, are electrified by this hospitality here. This is, Pam uses the word photovoltaic, and I've been thinking about that, and this as a kind of photovoltaic, you know, event, text event, and society of friendship, kind of thing. I write a lot about society of friendships and manuscript circulation in the 17th century. This encounter, to use Pam's phrases from the poem I read, not just, no, from everywhere, a second ago, Everywhere Pan, a second ago, always known, conditioned to fortune and the mind's direction. I was brought up on Oxford Authors, those blue-covered books, you know, the Oxford Wordsworth, the Oxford, when I was eight. I was asked to bring my favourite book to school. I took the Oxford Matthew Arnold. I didn't know, you know, what that meant. I must have known something, I think. I mean, I knew other kids weren't bringing it. And, you know, my work had merit of a kind. And, you know, that plus Australian first editions. You know, we watched BBC police shows at night in prime time. American sitcoms illicitly after school. We were not really allowed to watch anything not on the ABC, but Mum wasn't there, you know, when we got home from school. She was at university. Classic Hollywood double features on TV, which we were supposed to watch. You know, that was, I formed the idea that I would like to become a musical comedy star for a time because of that, you know, watching these dancing movies. But I, you know, I moved on from that. You know, when it wasn't that, it was listening to American protest songs and pop music. The first pop single I ever bought was Petula Clark, Love, This Is Our Song, My Song, I've forgotten. As well, we had a shelf of Russian literature in translation. My parents were communists. Still communist at that time when I was little. So I would read Pasternak, Akhmatova, Mandelstam, Yevtushenko, who came to Perth. I didn't leave Australia until I was 22 in 1983 to start my PhD in London, as Pam was saying, pre-personal computers, pre-internet, mobile phones, pre-even phone cards. I could ring home once a year for 10 minutes. I would ring up Mum on my birthday. This is what it was like being, you know, her daughter. I ring her on my birthday and she would be busy. She would be busy with writing projects, but I would ring up anyway. And this is my complaint, part of it. I could, you know, it's endless. Only then, alone in London, I did not know another person when I went there, did I realise how profoundly attached I was to American techs when they weren't there. I had expected to forego Australian reference points, but I hadn't thought about the American everything that was so deeply embedded in my experience. I had no idea that Main World was not this syncretic colonial thing that I had lived in, and that it would be entirely differently configured once I got to England. So, you know, when I was doing my PhD, no one there thought that I should include Australian poems in my thesis on masculinology. They also thought that I shouldn't advert to them being masculine elegies, but that's another story. But everyone thought it was a big problem to write on both British and American poems in the same thesis. That was like a big no-no, which I just, you know, did anyway, but was constantly told off for. And that was a much bigger problem in the minds of, you know, my advisors there. I mean, you know, in a way that was perfectly continuous with that economy, you know, it wasn't bad advice in that sense. You know, it was, you know, pitched to the market. But I just kept sort of going along thinking, how can it be? You know, I didn't know that this would happen. And when I did finally come here to America at the very end of 1989 to go to the MLA, in DC on my way back to take up a job at Sydney University, where I've worked ever since, so 26 years. I was so overwhelmed by the fact of America, you know, so unprepared for the kind of cascading sense of mediation that, you know, I could hardly bear it. In fact, I didn't go out of my room in New York for several days. I was just so, you know, freaked out, and I just watched the television inside the room. But by then, I had pretty much lost, you know, when I went to England, I knew about New York School, you know, knew about Beats and so on. But by the time I left, there were no American books in English bookshops. I mean, you know, there was Ashbery, maybe. But the only person I knew, ever met while I was there, who had read even Ashbery, was another postgraduate from New Zealand. And it was because he was also from this, you know, other strange, different world, you know, the non-English world. So, as Pam writes, everyone has a diagnosis, but I didn't have one yet, and I still couldn't quite say what it is, but I started to get the feeling that this Australianness was could be diagnosed as some kind of cultural position in set of terms in, you know, the Republic of Letters. And as I was coming here, I was reading Pam's book, Missing Up, on the plane, and I have in fact been going backwards and forwards between America a lot, so 5 times, I think, you know, that trip backwards and forwards in the last 4 months. And I've been carrying around Missing Up as a kind of blanket, you know, as a transferential object, partly because Pam goes in for these little books, and they're a great size to, like, you can literally put them in your pocket, and often they're smaller than this, and so they are these, you know, particular kinds of intimate, even sort of prosthetic objects to have with you, to hand. As I've been moving backwards and forwards across the date line, and one of the lines, or concatenating several lines, she writes that everything is going on, and that's what I love in her work, that everything is going on in a loiterature kind of way. She borrows that term, loiterature. Sitting there in the dark, in the simulated night, hemispheric crossing, an older flight attendant, a kind of old-style, genial man, came up to me, you know, a single woman is a target, and said, "Oh, what are you reading, you know, Missy," kind of thing. And I said, "Poetry." And he said, "You like poetry?" I said, "Yes." And I didn't expect it at all. He reached across, and before I knew what was happening, he took it out of my hand. It was open at a page. He looked at it, closed it up. He said, "Oh, I've got a friend who's a bush poet. Amazing." Walked away. I mean, I thought he did reasonably well, you know. And so I was left sitting there thinking about, kind of, you know, pissed off because my reverie was, you know, interrupted, but also thinking about Pam as a kind of bush poet. And, a poet of the neighbourhood, what she calls the midge world, or Zlin. I don't know if you say, Zlin?
Zlin.
And this syncretic world. And it reminded me too of when I was in Oxford on a postdoc, and this old Don, as they say, old professor, said to me, "Oh, you know," because I was the Australian, you must miss the silence and the wide open spaces, the panorama of Darlinghurst and King's Cross, you know, flitted through my mind. But this particular configuration of a republic of letters, I certainly did miss. And so just to sort of, how am I? Over.
We need to,
yeah. I'll wind up just very fast. Just say, you know, I want to kind of, you know, in the work that will be, I want to talk about Pam, first of all, in terms of a kind of post-cinematic libre composé intersecting with this acute photovoltaic sense of female complaint that can be understood as companionable, friendly, an intimate public of the kind Berlant writes of for those who have ears and eyes for it.